Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is called many things, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. As implementation of the law continues, so does the confusion. On today's program, we sit down and try to make sense of all of it. What will the law mean for Michigan and for you? And then on this 12th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, we talk with the Detroit Bureau correspondent for the new TV network, Al Jazeera America. But first, President Obama is conditionally endorsing a Russian offer for international inspectors to seize and destroy chemical weapons in Syria. It's an effort to avert U.S. missile strikes. The president, of course, addressed the nation last night amidst the continued erosion of support in Congress for strikes. The president's speech drew mixed reaction from Michigan's congressional delegation. Joining us now from Washington is Todd Spangler, the D.C.-based reporter for the Detroit Free Press. Always good to have you with us, Todd.
Thank you very much for having me again.
So we've seen some kind of interesting bedfellows here in this debate over Syria. Help us sort this all out, because it certainly is not as simple and clear-cut as Republicans are against it and Democrats are for it.
It most certainly isn't. I mean, you still have the sort of dovish qualities of many of the Democratic members of Congress who don't want to go against the president from their own party, but at the same time, don't really want to embrace military action, especially after what happened in Iraq with, you know, former President Bush.
Yes.
Really what you've been seeing that's the most interesting part of this. I don't think it's terribly surprising that there's a lot of Democrats out there who are sort of dragging their feet on which way to go with this for now and are undecided.
Sure.
The more interesting part of this is the Republican members who you might have thought would be more aligned with their leadership, more willing to take, you know, this, think there needs to be a response. Candace Millers of the world, mm-hmm. people like this, who are actually saying no and are aligning themselves more with these libertarian wing of the party, who is absolutely saying no, the Justin Amashes from Michigan of the world, who is a leading opponent of this. I mean, that's really where this break is happening and causing so many questions about whether this could pass in the House or not.
So what do you make of this and where they're standing? Does this speak a lot about the growing influence of that kind of that Tea Party libertarian component of the Republican Party is really kind of driving things?
Absolutely. I think that in large measure the Congress that we have now is, particularly the House, is a measure of those wars that were started under former President Bush. Without those wars, do you have a Barack Obama becoming president? Without that, do you have the reaction to that that sends a lot of these libertarian members into the House? I think there's a lot of people who are concerned or hear the message that a lot of Americans out there weren't crazy about those wars, didn't think we should be there in the first place, and any time that military action is brought up, they think unless there is a clear U.S. security interest at stake, we shouldn't be involved in it.
So going forward, Todd, do you see changing positions, or do you think opinions that are formed right now are pretty well set in stone?
It all depends on who is saying it and what that position is. For instance, you have people who are leaning no. You have, you know, members of Republican leadership in the House. For instance, Fred Upton is leaning no, but he's an undecided from Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Dave Camp, the Ways and Means chairman, is an undecided. Again, raising some doubts, but an undecided. Will those folks go against Speaker Boehner, who's a close ally of theirs? I think that's all going to depend on how this diplomatic effort plays out. Among the Democrats, I think the diplomatic effort is going to give them a lot of cover to vote for something if it comes to that.
Were you surprised at how quickly Speaker Boehner did kind of stand up and stand next to the president on this?
I was. He didn't really leave much to doubt very quickly.
Yeah.
But I do think that he was in a position with his own caucus, as well as just, you know, being the sort of politician he is, thinking that this is not something where you dilly-dally. This is something where you have to come out and say right away, This is something we should do. And I think he probably would fall in that camp of thinking maybe we should have done something even sooner.
Todd Spangler, D.C.-based reporter for the Detroit Free Press. Thanks so much, Todd.
Yeah, my pleasure. Anytime.
And now a quick update on a story that we have been watching for you here on Stateside, the story of Amir Hekmati, former U.S. Marine who grew up near Flint, currently being held hostage in Iran. In a new letter to Secretary of State John Kerry, Hekmati says Tehran is keeping him for a possible prisoner exchange, and he describes miserable prison conditions. A family spokesman said Hekmati's sister, Sarah, authenticated the letter. She says the handwriting is her brother's. Hakmati's been detained on what the U.S. says are false espionage charges. We have talked with Sarah Hakmati about her brother previously on Stateside. You can find that interview and more information about his story online at michiganradio.org. The push by fast food workers to make more than minimum wage has swept across the nation. And it's raised the question, can fast food restaurants actually pay their workers more than the $7.40 an hour minimum wage? If they do, will they last? Is it sustainable? The owners of fast food restaurant Moo Cluck Moo think the answer is yes. Moo Cluck Moo serves up burgers and chicken and shakes in Dearborn Heights in Wayne County. And starting wages at Moo Cluck Moo, $12 an hour. Joining me is the co-founder of Moo Cluck Moo, Brian Parker. Hello, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So you and your partner, Harry Morehouse, decided that you were not going to follow the fast food norm of minimum wage. Why was that?
Well, you know, quite honestly, when we opened up, I can tell you, I didn't really even know what minimum wage was. We just thought that starting people based on our business model and based on what type of food we're preparing and how we want our customer service to feel, we just thought that $12 an hour was a good starting pay for somebody that wanted to spend their time dedicating and focused and working with us and helping achieve that model. I've been reading a lot lately on response to some of the things that have been going on about Moo Cluck Moo and our wages.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, people are saying, oh, well, you know, just the burger flipper is a burger flipper. And boy, I'd love to challenge that. And I'd love people to come in and talk to me personally about, you know, what a burger flipper is and does versus what we're asking our team to do.
So what kind of applicants did your $12 an hour offer attract?
We've got a great cross-section, quite frankly. We have people of different ethnicities, different religious beliefs, and different backgrounds. The backgrounds basically are from the food industry, of course. But, you know, that all comes from different walks, different service, different types of food. And I think what attracted them was the concept. We tried to keep the menu very simple. We tried to keep the offering very simple. And the key is doing it very, very well.
One of the issues that we hear about in this conversation about how much a fast food worker should make is that if workers are paid more than cost rise, so is the food that your customers buy at Moo Cluck Moo, is it more expensive because of the higher wages?
I don't think it is. I think we're right in line with what we feel as a consumer, what a burger should cost and what a chicken sandwich should cost.
So what would a good burger be at Moo Cluck Moo?
A good burger is $3. And if you add cheese and or bacon, it's an extra dollar.
Okay. So how are you managing to not have higher prices, but yet still pay your employees and survive?
Well, we're constantly analyzing productivity. We're constantly analyzing the amount of people that it takes per day, per shift, per rush to, again, get the food prepared in a way that's healthy and consistent and savory. So my partner and I are watching every single day and monitoring sort of the ebb and flow of, you know, what constitutes a busy day, what constitutes a busy hour, and then we adjust our hours accordingly. And the other thing that we do is, of course, we want to make money in our endeavor so that we can grow, but we're not wallowing in funds and extra money that we don't want to share with the rest of the team. So I guess we want to spread the wealth.
Do you see yourself being able to actually increase what you're paying workers?
Oh, we'd love to. I mean, we started everybody at $12 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And a few of those people have stepped up and have taken on more responsibility and sort of spread themselves out a little bit more to get into other things in the operations. And right now I could say that our average worker is between $13 and $14 an hour. So we thought, why don't we just get up to $15 an hour and, you know, not create this false sense of bonus structure, and let's put the money on the table now. You know, let's let these people feel good about what they do. And also, on our part, it allows them insight into, you know, it shows our appreciation.
So you're going to 15 an hour?
we are definitely going to 15 an hour starting October 1st.
I know it hasn't been long since you opened in April, but how are you doing? And do you see this? Do you see yourselves being able to add more locations?
We are definitely looking at adding more locations. So to answer your first question, we're doing great. This month, we look to September is turning a profit. We want to be profitable this month. We've spent a lot of time and dedication focused on advertising, you know, again, looking at the operations and looking at what we can do better, more efficiently. And in terms of growth, absolutely, we're all for it.
Well, Brian Parker, what do you think the fast food industry could take away from what you and Harry are doing with Moo Cluck Moo?
I think it's the underlying messages is recognize the engine room, recognize the people that are working hard to make things better, not only for their company, but for themselves. I think that's the underlying message here, is just looking at who your team is and showing them that we're all in this together and that we're all working hard.
Brian Parker, co-owner of Moo Cluck Moo, which is in Wayne County. Thanks for talking with us today, Brian.
Cynthia, thank you so much.
In the quest to improve life in Michigan cities, one of the biggest challenges often comes down to transportation. And one of the most problem-plagued, dysfunctional bus systems in the entire state is in the city of Detroit, where using a bus to get from point A to point B can become a Herculean task. And for kids, it's an even greater challenge, getting them to and from enrichment and after-school programs and doing it safely. But there is a solution to that challenge which launched this summer that's worth looking at, and it may have lessons that can apply to cities all over Michigan. It's called the Youth Transit Alliance. It's a pilot program funded by the Skillman Foundation, a public-private partnership between the Detroit Bus Company and area youth groups. So let's find out how it works. Joining us is Andy DiDerossi, who's the president and founder of the Detroit Bus Company. Hey, Andy.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. And Nina Ignazik is with us. She's the project editor for Model D's transportation series. Hello, Nina.
Hello. How are you?
Good. So before we find out how Andy and his company fit into the Youth Transit Alliance, give us a deeper sense of what need this program fills.
Well, the program fills a really dire need in the city of Detroit, where kids have no way to get to and from their youth programs in the summertime and or after school. And so there had been several previous attempts to deal with this problem. Youth programs either had their own buses or their own vans, but that required them to have to maintain those buses and vans and sink resources into them. Or even the counselors frequently were responsible for transporting kids, which also took away from the programs that they were supposed to be delivering. So it's an ongoing problem, and the Detroit Bus Company came up with a really unique solution to address it where it has not been able to be successfully dealt with in the past.
So Andy DiDerossi, tell us about your Detroit Bus Company.
Yeah, so we launched the Detroit Bus Company in December of 2011 to work on transit issues here in the city of Detroit. We dug into the issue and we found that it was 100 times bigger than we could have ever imagined. And there were so many different subsets of needs in the city. You know, there's a need for jobs access. There's a need for getting to the city and back to the suburbs for work. There's transit that needs to happen within the city. We have no good connection to our airport. And then finally, we found that youth simply couldn't get to the resources that were available. There's all these great after-school programs, but kids weren't attending them because they couldn't get there or get back safely at the end of the program. So we were approached by the Skillman Foundation in October of 2012 to work on a solution for this. We had approached it with a very traditional method. We looked at the problem and estimated it would take about 20 buses. And then when we delivered that budget, we were told that exceeded the budget for all of the youth development programs combined.
Whoa.
So it obviously wasn't going
to
work.
Back to the drawing board.
Yeah, exactly. So we took a couple months and we looked at the exact issue, and we discovered that frequently when a program would rent a bus for itself, that bus would work for a short period of time and then sit for a number of hours that program was paying for and then do the return trip. Well, because there's over 40 programs in Southwest Detroit alone, we had pooled these resources together and made it a neighborhood-wide issue. And so now we have, through our dynamic routing system, two buses doing the work of 20 buses, and obviously a huge cost saving. So what wasn't possible before is now possible and working really well.
And what does dynamic routing system mean? How does this differ from a fixed route system?
the fixed route system would basically mean the program would rent a bus, it would pick up a select number of children, and then they would go to the program and then return at the end of the day. What this does is our system has the youth sign up online, have their parents sign up online where they're at. It develops a route every day for the bus to pick up the youth on the way to the program, so there's a mixed load of students going to different programs. And then this bus travels between what we've designated as safe spaces, pickup and drop-off spaces. And these kids congregate there, get on the bus, get to the programs, and at the end, we bring them back to these spaces that are very close to their homes, or if it's after dark, we bring them straight home. But the route is different every day because the needs of the programs are so varied. And before, this would be too labor-intensive for somebody to handle, but using a few simple pieces of software and a couple smartphones, we were able to overcome that hurdle and bring this transit to life.
So, Nina Ignacek, as you kind of studied this and watched how it played out over the summer, how well did all of this work?
Well, I thought it was really impressive. The bus driver had just an encyclopedic knowledge of the city of Detroit, which I think you need to have, especially if your route is changing every day. But also, it was interesting to me to see, so that they have two people on the bus. There's the bus driver, and then there is a sort of a concierge person that goes out and gets the kids and brings them on. And the concierge was in touch with these programs on his cell phone constantly, so they were able to make changes on the fly as needed. And really, the looseness of it and their ability to be adaptable and flexible really impressed me.
And what about efficiency and cost compared to a traditional fixed route system? How much more efficient and cost effective was all of this?
To sum it up, the system is 90% more cost effective than a traditional system would be. So whereas the original solution was $2.2 million, we were able to achieve this for just under $200,000. And that is scalable. We're able to bring that to other neighborhoods quite readily and to other use cases, to jobs access and to other big problems here in the city that were once insurmountable.
And how many kids were getting moved around for that under $200,000?
It was about 200 children that rode in the month of July alone, unique riders.
Nina, how likely do you think it is that the Youth Transit Alliance, this was a pilot project, number one, can be extended, made permanent, and also expanded, number two, beyond Southwest Detroit?
Well, I think it's going to depend on the communities seeing the value and wanting this to happen. I mean, right now it's being funded through a grant program, and there probably will be additional grant programs in the future, but going forward, I spoke with Terry Whitfield and with Chris Bull from the Skillman Foundation about future potential funding for the program, and they spoke to the need to diversify the funding sources, whether it's businesses supporting this, other community organizations. So there will need to be funding looked at, but the model seems to work.
I'm wondering, for both of you, the thoughts that you might have, what would it take for entrepreneurs and for youth nonprofits to pool their resources and do something similar to the Youth Transit Alliance in other cities in Michigan? I'll start with you, Andy, as the entrepreneur.
Sure. So I think it's important to identify a need that's very clear and direct. Frequently, a lot of entrepreneurs try to invent an issue that might be fun to solve. But I would find a very simple, very basic issue. You know, transportation is just one thing here. The programs themselves are the bread and butter of the success because they're working to connect us to the students. They're actually providing the development resources. But it's important to find an issue and then find how you can reinvent how that issue is being solved, if it's being solved at all. There's still a number of completely unsolved problems here in the city of Detroit and throughout Michigan abroad. And there's a number of technologies out right now, like I said, smartphones and some simple pieces of code that can really bring change to stuff like this that previously, 5-10 years ago, wasn't possible.
What are your thoughts, Nina?
Well, I think that what the Detroit Bus Company has demonstrated is that these problems are very intractable, but when there's a problem that can be addressed by communication and by enhancing communication, that's where these technologies and smartphones and the internet and crowdsourcing can really come in and make a difference. Not every problem may be able to be solved in that way, but a lot can. And wherever there's an opportunity to create a system where people can communicate more easily than they could before, I think that's really probably a ripe area for entrepreneurship at this time.
That is Andy DiDerossi, who's the president and founder of the Detroit Bus Company, and Nina Ignazik, who's the project editor for Model D's transportation series. You can learn more about the Youth Transit Alliance and the other programs that are offered by the Detroit Bus Company at their website, thedetroitbus.com. And we've also put a link on our site at michiganradio.org to Nina's story, her feature on the Youth Transit Alliance done for Model D Media. Thank you so much to both of you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, speaking of buses and school and kids, anyone who's been a parent has probably suffered through the excruciatingly embarrassing moment when your little darling lets loose with a word that he or she undoubtedly picked up at school or on the bus or daycare, never at home. Well, that universal family moment is the subject of a wonderful new children's book written and illustrated by my next guest. It's called The Very Inappropriate Word. It's about a typical little boy named Michael who loves collecting words, all kinds of words. Author Jim Tobin joins us here in the studio. And the last time we talked, it was a great conversation about the history of streaking at the University of Michigan. And now here we are talking about cussing.
I know. I actually think about serious, non-dirty things, but I just don't write about them, I guess.
Welcome back. And with Jim is illustrator Dave Coverley, who draws the award-winning cartoon strip Speed Bump and who works out of his attic studio here in Ann Arbor. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
Well, I have to say, as a mother and now a grandmother, I found this just a delicious book in so many ways. I have to ask you, Jim, what got you thinking about doing a children's book about a child picking up a big old cuss word?
Well, Dave may remember better than I do when we came up with this idea. This is our second book together, and we were looking for a new topic. And somehow it was the title itself that occurred to us.
Yeah, I think it was you. I mean, I think it occurred to you.
Yeah.
Because that's a word you hear all the time, inappropriate, like especially
inappropriate.
At school and things.
Yeah.
Is like that's a very inappropriate thing to do, a thing
yes.
to say, et cetera. And inappropriate, I think we were talking about inappropriate.
What is it?
Why that word and what does that mean and what does it mean to kids?
And it's a total adult word aimed
exactly.
down because you
exactly.
never hear that aimed up unless
exactly.
they're parroting
exactly.
you.
And as the book points out at one turn in the story, Michael is told this is an inappropriate word that he has picked up. And he realizes very quickly that that's just the adult word for bad. Adults these days, we sort of hedge. We don't want to label something bad or dirty.
Right.
So we say, oh, it's inappropriate. Well, the kid knows what the adult really means by that.
Tell us a little about Michael.
Michael developed in some ways, Michael is really more, I think, Dave's creation than mine. When I think of him now, I think of the way Michael looks. The idea, you know, the idea started with a little boy who got caught up with this inappropriate word. And it did occur to me that all of a sudden when I was starting to do the text that this was a little boy who was really fascinated by words. He loves all kinds of words. And so the sort of conceit of the story is that he literally collects these words, which are not floating around in space as speech. They're actually solid objects.
Yeah.
And so in Dave's drawing, they become these actual word balloons that he can take home with him.
And tuck them under his bed where
yeah,
little boys keep their treasures.
That's right, where kids keep their treasures. Mm-hmm. And so he's got a big box of words under his bed.
Dave, I love the way you chose to let us see how Michael hears this word.
Oh, thanks.
Tell us a little
yeah.
about that.
Well, I mean, that was sort of the crux of the book and the problem we needed to solve with the book was the fact that you've got a kid who loves words mm-hmm. and he collects words. But how do you show that?
Yeah.
The only way to show that was to actually show the words. And then when you show the words, to have them be things that he literally collects so that when he has these things, then you can use them.
And it gave you great fun with your word bubbles because
yeah,
you could
exactly.
make it a brick or a stretchy
right.
thing or whatever.
So when you see the words, they look like
yes.
the word balloons look like the words. And so when he collects them, he can do different things with them. And so from my perspective, I mean, having the inappropriate word, it was pretty easy to come up with. You know, you use those. Jim found out it's called a Grawlix,
okay.
all the little symbols inside of
we
a
all
word
know
balloon.
Them, the lightning
the
bolts,
books,
and
right.
the comic
yeah.
books. And I thought it was a delicious touch to have Mom fixing the toilet and boom, out comes the word.
Yeah.
Where did the thought process go that it's going to be Mom and she's got the tools hanging out of her jeans and she's fixing the toilet?
Well, I think the fact is that, you know, our generation of parents, at least the people I hang out with, we do use swear words. We try not to use them in front of our kids, but sometimes accidentally we do.
Yes, we do.
So, yeah, we, you know, kids hear words on the school bus and it's and on the playground, but they hear them from their parents too. And many parents swear fairly indiscriminately. Yeah, so I think we wanted to do this in a subtle way that parents would recognize themselves in the story. So,
but I also love that you have mom fixing it. You didn't have the typical predictable, well, dad's home and whacks his finger with a hammer and cusses.
Well,
kudos for that.
Wives fix toilets too.
Yeah, that's what I love about Jim's writing though. It's been described as repertorial because it's very straightforward, but it's full of surprises. I mean, it's really, really easy to draw for the things that Jim writes because he lays them out, but he gives you room sort of to work. And so you say things like that with the mom fixing the toilet. And it's like for me, I see the image and it's like that's so much fun as an illustrator to be able to do that.
You didn't turn this into the predictable mom or dad scolds little Michael or the teacher scolds little Michael. You really turned it into a wonderful teachable moment.
Well, yeah, we liked the idea of this smart teacher who has probably dealt with this problem many times before. And I think the idea just was that she wanted to show Michael, not that this was a bad word, which I think makes it more attractive to kids. We like bad things. We like horror movies. Yeah. We like scary stuff.
Kind of stuff. Yeah.
We're fascinated by bad things. We just don't talk about them openly that way. We don't talk about our fascination with them. Kids feel that. This teacher recognized that, but what she really recognized was that Michael loved all words. And the best thing was to redirect him to the library in a search for a whole bunch of cool words, not just this one, which he's going to keep and he's going to use at some point, but to reinforce his love of words generally.
And
so that's where the story goes.
And it kind of takes the power away from the shiny new word because he's got a whole bunch of more appropriate shiny new words.
Totally nailed it because that's what we talked about. That's what we talked about the most.
Yeah.
Is how do you wrap up this kind of thing? Because once he has the word, you don't unhave the word.
Yeah.
You know, you always have that. So what do you do with that? You can't just say, oh, never use that again. And Michael ends the book by saying, I'm never using that word again, because that doesn't happen.
No.
And kids are smart. They know that doesn't happen.
If anything, they will use it more if you say never use that word again.
Exactly.
One more thing before we wrap up, and I wanted to get your thought process and on the fact that this is clearly a multiracial family. What went into that? Was that the illustrator just kind of taking that and deciding to apply that? Or?
It was.
It was.
I decided to ask forgiveness instead of permission.
Permission.
Yeah, because I really liked that idea, and I liked the blended family. I liked the it went in sort of concert with having mom fix the toilet. I mean, I wanted this to look like a book that could be for everybody and anybody. And I mean, obviously you have to pick a gender, and we felt early on, Jim knew immediately that it had to be Michael.
Part of that was that our first book was called Sue McDonald Had a Book, and that's about a little girl.
Yeah.
So it was
and
we, time.
The next book we're going to do a boy.
Right. Yeah. But it worked better, I think for
too.
A boy
mm-hmm.
to do this.
The very inappropriate word with Jim Tobin, illustrated by Dave Coverley. And it was really fun talking to both of you and a very fun book. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is a new eye on the news coming out of Detroit and out of Michigan. Al Jazeera America was launched August 20th on cable lineups in 48 million American homes, and it's opened 12 bureaus across the nation, including a Detroit bureau. Joining us now is the correspondent for this new Detroit bureau, B.C. O'Neely-Erie. Welcome, B.C.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
You know, BC, I'm speaking to you literally on the 12th anniversary of 9/11. And for so many Americans, their first contact with Al Jazeera came after the attacks, when it was airing videos of Osama bin Laden and running stories criticizing the Bush administration. And that gave people a sense that Al Jazeera was anti-American or a mouthpiece for terrorists. What kind of response have you gotten from people as they hear that you're now with Al Jazeeera America?
Well, I can tell you the response from family and friends has been very positive. I understand that there are people out there who still may have a negative perception of Al Jazeera, but I believe that viewers who are on the fence just give AJAM a try, they just might be pleasantly surprised by what they find.
How large a gap is there between that public perception of Al Jazeera and what you're seeing?
What do you mean by that?
That public perception that people maybe aren't sure what Al Jazeera stands for, and then here you are, part of the team now, so you're really seeing it from the inside out.
Right. Well, one of the things that I'm most impressed about Al Jazeera is its coverage. I'm seeing stories from places across the world, some places I didn't even know existed. So, I mean, I just see really fact-based journalism, an organization that's about integrity. Again, I understand that there may be some negative perceptions, but I think that once they take some time to actually watch the network, that they may change their mind about it.
What will we be seeing when people tune in?
Well, people should expect great news coverage. Al Jazeera America has access to the largest news gathering service in the world. So, as I mentioned, viewers will come across many stories that aren't covered by other networks. Another draw for me coming to the network is that I'll have the opportunity here in my area to really focus on human interest stories. The viewers will, again, see in-depth coverage of how domestic news and world events affect their lives. Like right now, Syria has been making the headlines. And mm-hmm. so they have been, you know, in Syria. They have correspondents, you know, on Capitol Hill, outside the White House. So it's like they have a lot of resources and they devote a lot of time to really explaining the story in an unbiased way.
BC, do you expect to have an uphill climb to win viewers over to Al Jazeera America?
You know, I think that it will be interesting. I'm not sure. Like, I really can't speak on that, but I think that it will be interesting. I think that there seems to be quite a bit of interest, at least with people that I'm talking to. People are reaching out to their cable provider because, as you mentioned, right now we're just reaching about 48 million households. And I know that there are still some things being worked out with a couple network or cable providers. So I think that once we're on the same playing field as every other network, that there, you know, really may be a chance to succeed.
What's behind that interest that you speak of? You say, you know, people are interested in seeing what you're doing. What do you think drives that interest?
I think it's because of the name. I think it's because of Al Jazeera America. And I think that there's just a curiosity, you know, is it what some people who have negative perceptions about it believe, or is it something different? And I know that amongst a lot of people that I know, they are aware that Al Jazeera really has a reputation of just being like real fact-based. They're not throwing their opinion. The reporters and the anchors aren't throwing their opinions into their storytelling. You know, it's just these are the facts. You decide for yourself.
BC O'Neill-Erie, who is the Detroit correspondent for Al Jazeera America. Thank you so much for talking with us, BC.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we certainly have been flooded with news coverage of the Medicaid expansion in Michigan, the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, the soon-to-be-unveiled health care exchanges. But it is all confusing and it's challenging, even to those who work in the field of healthcare coverage. We wanted to see if we could get a firmer grasp on what all of this means in real-world terms. Who's in? Who's not? What does it mean for you, the consumer? Joining us is Marianne Udo Phillips. She directs the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation. It's a nonprofit partnership between the University of Michigan and Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. Marianne joins us now. Welcome to the program, Marianne.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Does it seem like there has been such a political storm over the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, that the nuts and bolts reality to consumers has kind of been lost in all of this?
Oh, absolutely. There is so much misinformation out there about the Affordable Care Act, and people have heard so many opposing things and scary things that I think people are tremendously confused about this law.
And even when it comes to confusion, I have to say I read your blog post on chrt.org. It's the website for the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation. And your blog post actually made me feel better about how confusing this is, because you write about how very hard it was for your team to put together a flow chart of the ACA from a consumer perspective. Why is it so hard?
Oh. Well, you know, it's a very complicated law. And I think one of the things that people don't really understand is what the framers of this law tried to do was to do something that really wasn't a radical change to healthcare in America, that actually built on our existing system. But our existing system is really a non-system.
Hmm.
It's fragmented, it's confusing, and so the framers tried to sort of fill in a whole bunch of gaps rather than just changing the whole system. And that made it very complicated.
I know. You actually describe it as something similar to a Rube Goldberg machine. But you point out the ACA, you say, is the system Americans asked for, even if we don't understand it?
That's exactly right. You know, we had proposals in Congress that really would have been simple, that were, you know, there was a bill in Congress that would have been 14 pages in length that would have provided universal coverage to everybody in this country. And it would have looked much like the Canadian system. It would have been called Medicare for All. But Americans really, really don't want that. You know, if you ask in survey data, even though people say they're unhappy with their health insurance, you know, about 85% of people in this country have health insurance, and they say they really don't want to change that. So it was a system. You know, the framers looked at our 100 years of history of trying to get some reform in health care, and they said, you know, we just can't do something that's totally different from where we've been.
So we have this thing that is hugely complicated and hard to understand. So how can people who right now do not have medical insurance, haven't been able to pay for medical insurance, how can they figure out, am I in or am I not?
Well, they're the most fundamental way. First of all, there'll be lots of advertising. There'll be lots of navigators out there. I just saw this morning that, you know, even places like Rite Aid and, of course, all the hospitals will have people to help folks figure it out. Yeah. But probably the quickest and easiest way is to go to the government's website, which is just healthcare.gov. And people can plug in information about themselves, about their income, and it will tell you, and they say what state you're in, and it'll tell you, A, where you can get more information, but, B, what you're eligible for.
Because that's where it's very, very confusing. And we know that the ACA will extend health care coverage either through Medicaid eligibility expansion or offering tax credits to subsidize insurance bought through the state exchanges. And we know the exchange is coming very soon.
Yes, it is. It's coming in something like 22 days.
Well, let's first of all talk about the Medicaid expansion, because it was such a huge political story in Michigan throughout the year. We know it'll be expanded to people whose income is below 138% of the federal poverty level. Every story says that. But now, I did a kind of an unscientific random test this week, and I asked people, can you tell me the federal poverty level? No one could. And then you have to do math, things like below 138% of the FPL. So bottom line, what income level can get you the Medicaid and what income level is too high?
Right. So if you are an individual and your income is less than $15,900 per year, you're eligible for Medicaid. If you are in a family of four and your income is less than $32,500 per year, you are eligible for Medicaid. So that's, I think, the easiest way to look it up without giving you all the variations in there.
That's nice and clear. Now, for those who do not qualify for Medicaid, how will the ACA work for them?
Well, for many people, they will be able to get tax credits to buy health insurance on these new health insurance exchanges. Also, I think they'll really be known as healthcare marketplaces, and I can explain those in a minute. Mm-hmm. But let me just tell you who that population is. So those are people who earn between 138% and 400% of federal poverty, which is, for an individual, between $15,900 per year and $46,000 per year. And for a family of four, between $32,500 per year and $94,200. So it's really quite a wide range of people who would be potentially eligible for a tax credit.
And when they go on the state health care exchange in 22 days, coming up in October, what will they find and what kind of prices can people expect to find?
Well, you know, of course, that's going to be very interesting. We haven't yet seen the prices announced in Michigan. We're expecting that those will be announced in a couple of weeks, maybe a week or so before the exchange opens up for enrollment. And the pricing's really going to depend. It's going to depend very much on the type of coverage. There are going to be multiple plans that are going to be offered on the exchange. And this could be a little bit confusing for people, which is why the law built in these navigators to help you figure it out. Mm. They design plans that are named metal plans, bronze, gold, silver, and platinum. And each of those plans has a different scope of benefits. Obviously, the platinum has the broader benefits, more more coverage, lower copays and deductibles generally than the bronze plans. So people will have a choice of those range of plans, and they'll have a choice of different insurers. We know in Michigan there are 14 insurers who have said they want to offer coverage on the exchange. So there'll be a lot to choose from. In fact, in Illinois, their exchange, they've already announced the plans on their exchange, and they had over 100 plans, 144, I think, plans on their health insurance exchange. So there'll be a lot of choices for people.
So many circumstances can find a home in all of these.
That's absolutely right. And the pricing is going to depend on the type of plan you choose and, you know, what your age is. So, you know, for many people who are older, who are sicker, who've had difficulty finding affordable coverage, I think the prices are actually going to come down. But if you're younger, they might go up, because that's part of what the Affordable Care Act was designed to do, is it designed to compress those rates.
I'm speaking with Marianne Udall Phillips, who's director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation, trying to take a consumer eye view of the upcoming changes through the Affordable Care Act. So, Marianne, let me give you a for instance, and because I think there are a lot of people who are still like, where will I fit in and what will this mean for me? So let's say you're in your 50s, you own your own small business, you're basically working for yourself as a tradesman. So you were hit very hard during the Great Recession, you even had to take a second job to keep the roof over your head, and you certainly could not afford to buy medical insurance. So now here you are. You're suffering from a hernia. It makes it hard for you to work. You've been to the emergency room for this painful hernia, but you were sent home. It wasn't deemed enough of an emergency to operate. So here you are. Your income for 2012 was just under $21,000. What is the outlook for someone like this?
Well, somebody who's like that and whose income is you're at about $21,000, you would be eligible for a subsidy on the a tax credit on the health insurance exchange to purchase health insurance, and you could, you know, buy coverage on the exchange with help from the federal government to make that coverage affordable. And the tax credit ranges depending upon your income and depending upon the premiums of the plans that you choose, but it could become very affordable for you. Let me give you an example, because we've actually been looking at Cleveland. And so let me give you an example in Cleveland of what they're actually experiencing on their exchange. And this is for, you know, remember I said there are these metal plans. So this is for the silver plan. So very good coverage, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So in Cleveland, for a single adult who's 25 years old and has an income of $25,000 per year, so 218% of the federal poverty level, the premiums that are on the plan that are on the exchange right now are $196 per month for a silver plan.
Okay.
But that individual would get a tax credit of $52 per month. And so their actual cost for very good health insurance, full preventive benefits, hospital coverage, et cetera, would be $144 per month for that individual.
Okay.
So that's you know, the kind of thing that we're seeing out there for people who are going to be looking at the health insurance exchange. And there will be a calculator on the healthcare.gov website that will figure that out for you. It'll figure out what your tax credit is, what your income is, and so hopefully it'll make it easier for people to understand exactly what they can get.
And Marianne, the issue of, for example, let's just say this condition of this hernia, the pre-existing condition is not the challenge that it once was, correct?
That is absolutely right. And that is one of the most important things that people need to understand about this law. Starting January 1st, frankly, whether you buy coverage on the exchange or not, that ability to exclude somebody based upon their pre-existing conditions goes away. And that really was one of the most important things about this law. It's really designed to make the market work better and not exclude people who are sick, who are the ones who need the coverage.
Now, let's say this individual says, I still can't afford the $144 a month. Would this person be penalized for not buying insurance?
Well, the whole idea about the Affordable Care Act is to make health coverage affordable. And the way the law defines that, it varies a little bit based upon your income. So if you're at that 400%, that higher end of income, it can't cost you more than 9.5% of your income. And that's kind of the maximum that the law says it should cost. But if you are offered affordable health coverage, either that with this tax credit you can buy it on the exchange, or your employer offers you affordable tax coverage, and you choose not to get that coverage, then you could face a tax penalty when you pay your taxes.
Do you find or do you believe that the effects of the ACA will be evenly or unevenly felt throughout Michigan?
Well, certainly we know that the Medicaid expansion will have a bigger effect in some communities than others, because many more people in our state who live in certain communities are very poor and not eligible for Medicaid today. In particular, Wayne County has a very high rate of people who are uninsured and very poor. But so does the northern lower part of the peninsula. So many, many rural areas in our state have people who are uninsured and very poor. So geographically, it's Wayne County, the northern part of the state, and parts of the UP and the Thumb that actually will have the greatest impact of the Medicaid expansion.
Marianne Udall-Phillips, Director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation. Their website is chrt.org. We've put a link on our website for you at michiganradio.org, also to the healthcare.gov site that she referred to. Thank you so much, Marianne.
Great to be with you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Mercedes Mejia, and Katie Suha. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.